Our next speaker is Randall O'Toole. Randall is senior economist at the Thoreau Institute. That's spelled like Henry David. He's been the McCluskey Conservation Fellow at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, visiting scholar at the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley, where he is currently, and visiting scholar at Utah State University. In addition to his book that I pointed out before, The Vanishing Automobile and Other Urban Myths, he's the author of the book Reforming the Forest Service and is one of the nation's leading experts on forest management. His article, Is Urban Planning Creeping Socialism?, appeared in the Independent Review about a year ago. In 1972, Dr. O'Toole developed a market-based transportation plan for Portland, Oregon, in conjunction with some other colleagues, and his analysis of forest plans for more than half of the national forests included forests in more than 20 states and in every forest service region in the United States. Randall is one of the more innovative economists I know, especially dealing with complex issues such as urban development. Randall?
Well, thank you, David. I hate to be introduced as innovative, especially when Thomas Rubin is sitting here in the audience, and so many of the ideas that I'll be presenting I stole from him. Thomas is on some other people are on a email list called the Transport Policy List, and I occasionally fire off a broadside, and Thomas usually sends in about 3 or 4 pages of stuff an hour analyzing transportation policy. That if anybody brings up an issue in New Orleans or Alabama or anywhere in the country, he says, well, I was involved in that, and this is what the real story is. But anyway, I'm going to tell you a little bit about smart growth and urban areas. Can I bring that higher? Yes, I guess I can.
Usually the problem is it's too high.
There, how's that? Still higher?
We're running out of books here.
All right, that's good. All right, well, in criticizing smart growth, I'm not saying that we don't have urban problems. We've got all kinds of congestion problems. We've got air pollution problems that are diminishing, but they're still real. We've got housing affordability issues, and we have open space issues. And open space is a concern of a lot of people. Now, some people say that these problems are due to too much auto driving and too much low-density development, and they call this sprawl. And sprawl is a bad word. Now, I think of this as just suburbs and actually 20th, 21st century living, but they call it sprawl. Their idea is that we should spend our money on rail transit instead of highways, and that we should build high-density housing instead of low-density suburbs. And they call this smart growth. Now, it's wonderful how they've captured the language, because if you're not for smart growth, you must be for dumb growth. If you're not for rail transit, you must be against transit. And so they managed to capture the language, and one of our jobs is to capture it back. Now, they also want to have mixed-use developments, where you have housing upstairs from cafes and shops so that you can walk to do your grocery shopping instead of getting in your car and driving. And they paint a beautiful picture of what our urban areas are going to look like after we apply smart growth everywhere. But we really have to sit down and ask some hard empirical questions. Does smart growth work? Does it really reduce driving? Does it reduce air pollution? Does it cost less? And does it protect open space? Now, fortunately, for everybody except people living in Portland, Oregon, we can use Portland, Oregon as a case study, because Portland, Oregon adopted the strongest smart growth plan of any city and urban area in the nation. It adopted the plan in 1997, but it actually began implementing the plan several years before that. In fact, in 1979, they drew an urban growth boundary around the city and said, we're not going to have any development outside the boundary. The only way you're allowed to develop outside the boundary is if you own 160 acres of land and earn at least $80,000 a year farming it, and then you can put one house on it. But if you don't earn at least $80,000 a year, you can't even put a house on it. You must be a hobby farmer, so you aren't allowed to build outside the boundary. Now, when they drew the boundary, they initially said that as the population grew and the land, the vacant land inside the boundary got developed, they would expand the boundary. They would make it bigger. They weren't interested in restricting growth. They were only interested in channeling it, making sure that you didn't have what they call leapfrog development, which is a community appearing 20 miles outside of your urban area. But as Peter Drucker says, anything government does almost at once becomes moral. And so for a lot of people, the boundary soon became a sacred line that could not be moved at all. And so Metro, the regional planning agency in charge of Portland's planning and planning for the entire urban area, decided they would expand the boundary just a little bit here, but to accommodate an anticipated 80% increase in population, they would instead rezone neighborhoods inside the boundary to higher densities. So all of these purple areas, including individual neighborhoods and corridors between those neighborhoods, are to be rezoned to essentially double to quadruple the existing density. Now this means we have things like neighborhoods of single-family homes that have been rezoned for apartments, and so apartments start popping up in people's backyards. Also, in these neighborhoods, if your house burns down, you are not allowed to rebuild it. You're required to build a row house or an apartment or some other high-density housing. Most neighborhoods in Portland have one or two-story buildings, except for downtown, just like many other cities. But Metro is encouraging developers to build what's called high-density mid-rise, four- and five-story apartment buildings, so they can cram more people into a smaller area. And, of course, Metro is encouraging the transit-oriented developments, meaning the high-density mixed-use developments with the shops and retail offices and offices and things like that downstairs and apartments upstairs. Metro does allow single-family home sites in some areas, but they want them to be on very tiny lots. For example, the lots in this neighborhood have no backyard. Your back door opens on an alley, and the side yard is also very small. And Metro has decided to build 100 miles of rail transit. We already have 30 miles. They want about 100 miles more of rail transit in the area. And essentially no more miles of highways. They do say they're going to build some more highways, but they're going to exclusively serve freight areas. They don't want the freight to be congested, but they do want to have more congestion in the urban areas where people are going to drive to work or whatever. So they're going to build almost no new highways. Now, what is all this going to do? In 1990, according to Metro, 92% of all travel in the Portland area was by automobile. And about 2.5% was by mass transit. And a little bit was by walking and biking, 5%. Metro says, after they do all of these things, increase the density by 70%, build 120 miles total rail transit, and no new highways, the automobile will still provide 88% of all travel in the Portland area. This is Metro's projection. Transit will double from 2.5% to 5%, and walking and bicycling will increase from 5% to 6%. But the automobile is still the dominant form of transportation. Now, this chart is actually a little bit deceptive because it shows it as a percent. But remember, we're also expecting an 80% increase in population. So in terms of the number of actual miles driven, you're getting a two-thirds increase in the number of automobile trips and the number of automobile miles driven. That two-thirds increase translates to a huge increase in congestion. Now, they are predicting, as it shows here, about a 5% of all travel will be by mass transit. That seems to me to be pretty optimistic. Just looking at other cities around the country, New York City has about 11% of all travel is by mass transit. But that's the New York metropolitan area, not the city. But when we go to the next highest, it's the Boston metropolitan area, we're right at 5%. The San Francisco-Oakland metropolitan area is only 4%, and so is Chicago and Washington and Philadelphia are even less. Now, these metropolitan areas are characterized by high density urban cores with large numbers of jobs. Manhattan, until recently, had 2.5 million jobs in the urban core in Manhattan. And that makes it possible for rail transit to work. But in Portland, we only have about 10% of all jobs are in the downtown area. And that's true of most cities in this country. So you're not going to get a high percentage of people riding transit because they aren't going to be able to get to where they want to go on transit. Metro actually predicts that the number of miles driven per capita is going to increase in the next 20 years. And as a result, we're going to have a quadrupling of the amount of time people waste sitting in traffic each day. If you sit in traffic 10 minutes a day in Portland today, 20 years from now, you're going to be sitting in traffic 30 minutes a day or more. But they say that's okay because congestion is actually a good thing. Traffic engineers define congestion using a letter grade. A means no congestion, great. And F means flunk. It means stop and go traffic. Metro has actually said that they don't want to do anything that would reduce congestion on highways like this, and their goal is to allow congestion to increase to level F. Historically, traffic engineers have always tried to keep congestion down to what would be level C or at worst D, meaning you'd be going at about 45 miles an hour on a 70-mile-an-hour road, but you'd still be moving. You wouldn't be stop and go. Their goal is stop and go traffic because doing anything to increase highway capacity, as they say, would eliminate ridership on their beloved light rail lines. Well, I was going to say that with increasing congestion comes increasing air pollution. And I do have a slide somewhere on this computer showing that higher density areas tend to have the worst air pollution. If you compare EPA's ratings of air pollution, they have extremes, severe, serious, moderate, minor, zero. The highest densities are the extreme areas, and the lowest densities are the zero areas, and it just goes on through the line. Now, the smart growth advocates talk a lot about the costs of sprawl. They say that sprawl costs too much. It wastes money because we have to build services to all these low-density areas. But it turns out that Portland is finding that the costs of smart growth are a lot higher than anybody predicted. First of all, we've got the light rail line, which Dan already mentioned, doesn't carry very many people. Portland's light rail costs more to build than an 8-lane freeway, but it carries fewer people than 1/3 of a lane of that freeway. Now, I once gave these numbers to some planners, and one of the planners said, oh, that's too many numbers. Well, you should be able to handle simple arithmetic. This means light rail is costing 25 times what a highway cost to move the same number of people. Now, we also have all these high-density developments springing up all over Portland. But guess what? They didn't spring up by magic. We built the light rail line. We opened it up in 1986. We zoned all the land within a half mile of it to high-density mixed-use development. And 10 years later, nothing. Not a single high-density mid-rise mixed-use development appeared along the light rail line. And so the city of Portland said, all right, we're going to have to subsidize it. So they offered 10-year property tax waivers to anybody who would put in a high-density development. In some cases, they have bought land from developers and then sold it back to the developers, the same developers, for half the price that they paid for it, on the condition the developers will put in a high-density development. In other cases, they give developers direct grants, using, ironically, federal funds that are supposed to be directed at reducing congestion to put in a high-density development that's going to increase congestion. So they end up subsidizing smart growth all over the place, and it costs everybody in Portland a lot of money. Now, we talk about affordable housing. This may sound cheap in Portland compared to here. That little house I showed you that's on a lot with no backyard, that starts in the 190s. Now, for the Bay Area, that's cheap. But for Portland, that's expensive. 10 years ago, that house would have been in the 90s. Now it's in the 190s. What's significant about Portland is that mean family incomes have remained constant for the last decade, but housing prices have doubled. The result is that today, 10 years ago, 2 out of 3 families could afford a median-priced house. Today, only 30% of families can afford a median-priced house. That makes Portland, after the San Francisco Bay Area, just about the least affordable housing market in the country. By comparison, the Portlanders say, well, the advocates of smart growth say, well, the reason why Portland is unaffordable is because it's so popular. Everybody's moving in. Well, Portland has been growing at 2% a year during the 1990s. Las Vegas has been growing at 6% a year during the 1990s, and yet their housing market is still very affordable. More than 2 out of 3 families in Las Vegas can afford a median-priced home. The smart growth advocates say we need density, we need smart growth to protect rural open space and rural farms. But the Portland area, the Portland urban growth boundary, only occupies 3/8 of a percent of the entire state. When you add in all the other urban areas, and I'm talking about all the cities and towns down to a population of 9 or more, you're still talking about only 1.2% of the state of Oregon. When you add in all rural developments, including agribusinesses and roads and railroads and everything else, you're still only talking about 2% of the state. 98% of Oregon is rural open space. So we've been running scared. We've been imposing all these rules to protect rural open space, and it's not really threatened. California is not quite as well off. Only 94.5% of California is rural open space. So maybe it's more important that you do smart growth here than in Oregon, so you can save that. Nationwide, you can look. Almost every state is in the 90s, except for some eastern states. Nationwide, not counting Alaska, 95% of the country is in rural open space. You wouldn't know that if you just drove around on interstate freeways, which is what most people do. But what about prime farmlands? Not just open space, but prime farmlands. They're really valuable farmlands. In Oregon, the Willamette Valley was the Garden of Eden. The original Oregon Trail was people driving across, or driving, taking their wagons across the country to start farms in the Willamette Valley. And it is high productivity farmland. The Willamette Valley is 1/7 of the state of Oregon, and it holds 2/3 of its residents. Everything from Eugene to Salem to Portland, Corvallis, Albany, so that's all part of the Willamette Valley. And the Willamette Valley Livability Project, which is a smart growth advocacy group, commissioned a study to find out what was going to happen to the Willamette Valley's land in the next 50 years. First, they said how much of the land is urbanized today. Turns out 94% of the land in the Willamette Valley is rural open space. Only 5.9% is urbanized. If we keep all the current rules in place, including the rule that you can't build a house on rural land, rural farmland, unless you earn $80,000 a year farming it, then within 50 years, they anticipate that 6.6% of the Willamette Valley will become urbanized. But what if we got rid of all the rules? What if we let the free market rule, or as they put it, short-term economic gain, as opposed to sustainability? According to their study, if we did that, then 7.6 of the Willamette Valley will become urbanized, 1% more. All of these rules, all of the congestion, all of the air pollution, all of the unaffordable housing is a direct result of trying to save 1% of the Willamette Valley from being developed. And incidentally, only 20% of the Willamette Valley is farmed. So it isn't even necessarily a big trade-off between farms and housing. But on the other hand, if urbanization is not a threat to rural open space, there still is a threat to urban open space. And what is that threat? It's smart growth. This is an urban farm. It's inside the urban growth boundary, and so it is not a farm. Even though people farm it, it has been zoned high-density transit-oriented development. This golf course was zoned in 1980 for permanent open space, and of course the owner's got a big tax break. But now the municipality in which the golf course is located has to meet population targets given to it by Metro, and so to meet it, is it rezoned the golf course for high density housing and office space. And the city of Portland has even been selling some of its city parks to developers that cut at below market prices on the condition that they put in high density developments. Now the smart growth advocates say we need to do all of these things in order to save Portland and other cities from becoming like Los Angeles, which the Sierra Club calls the granddaddy of sprawl. But it turns out Los Angeles is the epitome of smart growth. It's the highest density metropolitan area in the country. New York has about 5,000 people per square mile in the metropolitan area, which includes New Jersey and parts of Connecticut, parts of New Jersey and Connecticut. But the Los Angeles metropolitan area is 5,800 people per square mile. Portland today is only about 3,000, but their goal is to become almost 5,000 per square mile by 2040. We also know LA is a great big freeway, and it's covered with pavement, right? Well, it turns out, again, this is a myth. LA has the fewest miles of freeway per capita of any urban area in the country. The average U.S. urban area has more than 100 miles of freeway per million people. Portland today has just about 100, but their goal is to get down to about 65. New York is 65. Los Angeles is only 50 miles of freeway per million people. That's why it's so congested. So congested because there's too many people crammed in too small of an area and there's not enough roads for them to drive around on. And that's why it's so polluted, because cars pollute more in congested traffic. So after promising to save Portland from becoming like Los Angeles, Metro actually wrote in one of their documents that Los Angeles displays an investment pattern we desire to replicate in Portland. They didn't say it very loud. They sent documents, they sent newsletters to every single household in Portland, but they did not include this sentence. This was in a document that you had to buy for $10 for a 30-page report. Now, as far as I know, I was the first one foolish enough to buy it. So if your goal is to turn your favorite urban area into the Los Angeles, the most congested, most polluted, one of the least affordable markets in America, then by all means, follow Portland's example and adopt smart growth policies. And that, of course, is what is happening here. The Metropolitan Transportation Commission is now considering and will soon adopt the 2001 Regional Transportation Plan. It dedicates 80% of all transportation funds and 80% of all capital transportation funds to 4% of all travel, in other words, to transit. And it includes all kinds of subsidies and incentives for smart growth development. They call it transportation for livable communities, meaning we'll pack a whole bunch of people in here and then maybe they'll ride BART. BART, incidentally, only carries, about 2% of all travel in the Bay Area? I think it's 2%. And that doesn't count San Jose, of course, just San Francisco, Oakland. Yeah, just the BART areas. So what is the solution to these problems? Dan has already talked about some of them, using congestion pricing, value pricing, tolls for congestion. One thing I wanted to mention that he didn't mention is you can use, if you've got one of these little passes, which are a little transponder you put in your window. If you've got one, you can drive up to certain McDonald's and order a meal and pay for it with that. You don't have to fumble for your change or anything at the drive-up window. Pretty soon, you'll be able to do all kinds of things. Like you hear about in Finland, you can take your cell phone and buy a Pepsi Cola out of a vending machine. Well, pretty soon, you'll be able to use your Fast Pass to do that, or use your cell phone to pay for your toll. Now, I want to talk a little bit in a little bit more detail about another idea, which is privatizing the neighborhood. Instead of having zoning done by cities or counties or regional governments, as we do in Portland, the planning and zoning should be done by individual neighborhoods and neighborhood associations. Now, Robert Nelson, who's a public policy professor at the University of Maryland, has written an article in the George Mason Law Review. I believe it was late 99. It's in your book. Okay. That's called Privatizing the Neighborhood. And he's proposed that we take cities that have zoning and allow neighborhoods to opt out of the zoning, and they can form their own neighborhood associations and then write their own restrictive covenants And this system, he says, and I agree, will be more flexible and more responsive to change in the long run, but it will also protect the neighborhoods as far as they want to be protected from changes they don't want. I would also propose that we take open space funds, instead of giving it to giant regional park districts, give the open space funds to the neighborhood associations, and then they can decide whether they want to use the funds for to create big open spaces somewhere, or to create playgrounds for their kids, or what proportion of funds should go for which. Now, there's a lot of information that I've just thrown at you. Of course, we'll have a question and answer period, but if you don't get a chance to ask a question, my email address is rot@ti.org, and my website is www.ti.org. So feel free to email me or look up the website. Thank you very much. Thank you.